Now that we are willing to grant you entry and even to welcome you so warmly into our home, why would you want anything more? Why would you want to stay different? Why would you want to stay separate?
The Tikva Fund presents Alien Invaders, Jewish Figures in Deronda's Britain, the third episode of an eight-part series on George Eliot's classic novel, Daniel Deronda, led by Professor Ruth Weiss.
One of the things I intend to do here is to show how the Jewish theme is entered into in this book, really slowly at first and very tentatively at first. We first see the introduction of Herr Klezmer, who is a musician who is employed at the House of the Arrow Points. And it's clear that he is a Jew. And it's clear that he has a kind of ambiguous status in the household. So that shows you really who this Jewish artist is, how this kind of Jew was becoming part of British society, namely a person who makes his impact on the society through excellence, through cultural exhibition and through cultural performance. This is a person whom everybody wants to have play in their homes, teach their children, and so forth. And yet, there's a tremendous amount of prejudice and suspicion of him. So that's one kind of Jewish theme that is introduced through him. What is this person doing in England, and how is England reacting to him? And then the second Jew who is really introduced is Mira, this young woman who is seen about to commit suicide by drowning herself in the Thames, and who is rescued by Daniel Deronda. And there you see a completely different version of the Jew. This is the person who has come fleeing from some other calamity, coming to seek freedom in England, but being totally lost there, not knowing whom to appeal to. And so there you see the Jew in need of rescue. So it's interesting that the way in which George Eliot introduces this question is through two kind of polar opposites. Today, I want to talk about, I guess, what can be described alien invaders from above and below. This is the question of Jewishness, which Eliot introduces into the book. I think the way a concerto might announce a minor key in a minor key, a version of the theme that it then expects to develop much more fully in the later movements. So the J word is first mentioned when Gwendolyn has to pawn her chain at the shop of Mr. Wiener, and she regrets how little she gets for it, thinking, these Jew dealers were so unscrupulous in taking advantage of Christians, unfortunate at play. So this is Gwendolyn's anti-Jewish prejudice, shows her blaming someone else for the loss that she clearly brought on herself. And it applies the category of Jews and Christians to a monetary transaction that she initiated and of which she is the beneficiary. She came to pawn that chain. So Jews were associated in literature, even more than they were in life, with the pawn shop at one level and with banking on the other. And when Daniel later enters the pawn shop of Ezra Cohn, it takes him some time before he can see the owners as regular human beings. One of the problems that may have been associated with the image of the Jew in England at the time is that Jews seem to appear in two dramatically different ways. On the one hand, you did begin to have, by the end of the 19th century, an influx of Jews from the continent who no longer felt comfortable in their place of residence in Europe, because Europe was slowly becoming more anti-Semitic, organizing its politics against the Jews. And in flight from that, Many Jews sought refuge in England because England was a much freer and more liberal society. So you had immigrants coming, immigrants in numbers such as had never existed before, by the thousands now coming. And so suddenly there were whole areas of London, for example, and other major cities where Jews were there. Who are these people? They seemed to be dirtier. They seemed not to know English well. They lived in their own neighborhoods. So like any immigrant group that comes before it's had a chance to acclimatize, these were, you could really see why certain xenophobic attitudes might develop, of suspicion and of fear. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you already began to have Jews, like the Rothschilds, you really began to have Jews in positions like Benjamin Disraeli, who became the Prime Minister of England. You began to have people, families, that had made a tremendous amount of wealth and that threatened from above. That is to say, these were no longer petitioners. These were no longer your immigrants. These were people who now threatened to be taking over positions of power from you and competing with you for certain kinds of power, both in politics and in finance and in the professions and in every other sphere, and certainly in culture as well. So this is one of the complications of the Jews in British society, that there was a kind of a perceived threat from above and below. So the Jewish theme is then picked up a couple of chapters later at the home of Gwendolyn's strongest rival for attention in Offendene, whose predicament is in some way similar to hers, but it acts as a counterpoint rather than a parallel. And this is Catherine Arrowpoint. She is an only child, not the way Gwendolyn is merely treated as if she were an only child, but she is an only child, and she is the heiress to the fortune of her doting parents, who indulge her musical talent by hiring for her the best European tutor whom they can find. Mrs. Arrowpoint, her mother, is a literary amateur who supports the romantic ideal in culture, yet nonetheless expects her daughter to marry the kind of suitor who needs a wife to further his political career or to complement his aristocratic title with the cash that he lacks. So these are the kind of guys who are pursuing Miss Arrowpoint. Like Gwendolyn, Catherine refuses to follow this script. She refuses to enter a marriage of social convenience. But quite unlike Gwendolyn, she carries through her rebellion and marries for love. The object of her affections is far from your dime novel hero. It's not exactly that, you know, romantic young man. He is Herr Julian Klezmer. Klezmer, of course, the Yiddish term for musician. And he is a temperamental Jew who conforms to the stereotype of the Jewish artist. Here, a pianist-composer who uses his talent to overcome the liabilities associated with his race. And you've noticed, which is how Jewishness is referred to throughout the novel, as it was in England at the time. The German term, there's a German term that's entered the English language called salonfähig, which derives from that period. It means that you're fit for salon society, acceptable to that social class. And I think it applies perfectly to the Jewish musician who is acceptable by virtue of his indisputable talent. So Herr Klezmer, who is described as a felicitous combination of the German, the Slav, and the Semite, has a similarly triple-braided function in the plot, I think, as an artist, as a kind of wandering Jew, and as representative of a new kind of aristocracy of merit that can no longer be patronized in the traditional ways. First, as the artist. And I think if you read some of him, he's a little bit caricatured, but on the other hand, also taken seriously. George Eliot ascribes to Klezmer some of her own occasional impatience with the way art has to earn its keep by satisfying buyers who don't fully appreciate what they're paying for. So you have him at one point saying quite impatiently, "No man has too much talent to be a musician. Most men have too little. A creative artist is no more a mere musician than a great statesman is a mere politician. We are not ingenuous puppets or ingenious puppets, sir, who live in a box and look out on the world only when it is gaping for amusement. We help to rule the nations and make the age as much as any other public men. We count ourselves on level benches with legislators, and a man who speaks effectively through music is compelled to something more difficult than parliamentary eloquence." So, in a sense, this is like Shelley's saying that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. But on the other hand, it's also shows you that he is taking himself very seriously and taking his art at a level of tremendous seriousness and comparing it, you see, with real governance, with really those who speak up in Parliament. So there's a little bit of George Eliot's own impatience in that, I think. But then she ascribes to Klezmer something else as well. He has a little bit of charm. On his first meeting with Gwendolyn, he seems, you know, almost as enamored of her or almost as taken with her as Deronda originally is. So it says, "His English had little foreignness except its fluency, and his alarming cleverness was made less formidable just then by a certain softening air of silliness which will sometimes befall even genius in the desire of being agreeable to beauty." So here we see that, like Deronda, Klezmer is also a little dazzled by Gwendolyn's beauty, but also like Deronda, he recoils when she offends his principle of excellence. So just as Deronda subordinates beauty to morality, Klezmer does the same thing according to the standard of artistic excellence. When Gwendolyn sings for the company and then fishes for his approval, he tells her, "It is always a pleasure to see you sing." And the narrator asks, "Was there ever so unexpected an assertion of superiority, at least before the late Teutonic conquest?" So this a little joke comparing Klezmer's chutzpah with the early German invasion of England makes fun of his arrogance, but without apologizing for his severity in telling Gwendolyn that she was badly taught and that her repertoire is comprised of timid crowd pleasers. The narrator remarks, "Woman was dear to him, but music was dearer." So otherwise obliging, Klezmer shows himself a priest in the defense of artistic standards. And I use the term priest advisedly in the same way that we will see it recurring in the religious imagery that defines Deronda's relation to Gwendolyn. And to anticipate maybe later chapters, if Mordechai functions as the Kohen in this book, Klezmer, the musician, is the Levite, right? The ancient classifications that once served a sacred purpose in Jewish religious life continue in modern Jewish forms, and this Kohen and this Levi are now in the service of improving the British as well as their fellow Jews. So that's the artist. Then secondly, Klezmer is a wandering Jew, and he is in the process of assimilating without ever denying his Jewishness. He is indifferent to the question of nationalism, Jewish or otherwise, having substituted for nationality an allegiance to music. And there is nothing about him of the cringing apologist who is the worst product of the Jewish exile. Quite the opposite. His chief attribute is his incorruptible authority, so that he always seems to loom over those who try to belittle him. When Mrs. Arrowpoint, his patroness, calls him in to let him know that they are going to disinherit their daughter, if she marries him, she threatens, you will not marry her fortune. And Klezmer replies, Madam, her fortune has been the only thing I have had to regret about her. Right? And a little later he says, I consider it out of the power either of you or your fortune to confer on me anything that I value. My rank as an artist is of my own winning, and I would not exchange it for any other. I am able to maintain your daughter, and I ask for no change in my life but her companionship. So, Jew and musician, he holds himself to an independent, principled, and implicitly higher standard, and he lets everyone else know it. So during the conversation then, between this wonderful conversation between the teacher and the student, when they finally make their feelings known to one another, Klezmer says he cannot take Catherine's advice to appease the suitor who has just insulted him. And he tells her, even you can't understand the wrath of the artist. He is of another caste for you, meaning he's of a lower caste for you. That is true, said Catherine with some betrayal of feeling. He is of a caste to which I look up, a caste above mine. So she confirms, basically, that this is a new caste system, and that the artist here is the real artist, the true artist, is supreme over the aristocracy which had tried to impose its status on him, over him. So George Eliot, as I say, lightly mocks Klezmer's inflated rhetoric and his pride, yet it is the pride of someone who has to stand up for himself. And then there is a third function, I think, of Klezmer. I don't want to reduce him to these categories, but he does play that kind of part in the book. He is the resident alien, and it is his role, among others, to expose and to foil the anti-Jewish prejudice. The Arrowpoints were pleased to maintain him as a cultural showpiece, but they are outraged when their daughter wishes to marry him. We judge the other characters in the book according to the levels of prejudice that they feel toward Klezmer, with the most admirable, like Hugo Malinger, being the least prejudiced, and his nephew, Henley Malinger, the most biased. But on the whole, the relatively quick acceptance of this marriage by the parents, initially strongly opposed to it, tells us which way the tide is going. We have to see how quickly the turnabout comes, right? They're opposed, it happens, they're reconciled, right? So as Britain got used to the idea of having Disraeli as their prime minister, a baptized but not at all humbled Jew, they were growing accustomed to Jews in the arts as well as in the trades and as well as in Parliament. So Klezmer is artist, Jew, and one who inverts the pattern of patronage by setting the standard of culture and dictating its price so that he becomes the arbiter of taste and everything else, and he becomes a social rival in this new aristocracy of good taste, of culture. The Arrowpoints, after all, are themselves upstarts, having made their money in trade. So now here is another upstart challenging their supremacy in salons and concert halls. Now, shortly before Julian Klezmer and Catherine Arrowpoint determined to marry, and just before Deronda sees Gwendolyn Harleth at that German resort, a second Jewish musician enters the story with a different challenge to British norms, from the bottom rather than the top of society. Mira Cohn, or Lapidoth, is a penniless refugee who is about to take her life. She doesn't threaten the self-importance of local aristocrats with a higher standard of culture and taste, but once she's rescued and shown kindness and hospitality, I would say that she poses a different and ultimately greater kind of challenge to her hosts. These two Jews, Klezmer and Cohen Lapidot, both reinforce and complement or balance one another. They are both unmistakably good at what they do. Mira has been on stage since childhood. She's been taught by very fine teachers and by hard experience. When Klezmer is asked to audition her, he in no way relaxes his artistic standards because he feels sorry for her or because he identifies with her. Not at all. He declares her voice fit only for the drawing room rather than grand opera. But he pays her the ultimate compliment. With a sudden unknitting of his brow and with beaming eyes, he put out his hand and said abruptly, "Let us shake hands. You are a musician." The highest praise that he can bestow upon her. This is a fraternity of merit into which you cannot buy your way or be granted your entry except through personal achievement, and that through a combination of inborn talent and very hard work. But alike in this sense, they are opposites in their Jewishness. Klezmer will never deny his Jewish origins, but neither will he ever seek out the Jewish community or try to perpetuate the Jewish people. He wants acceptance as a Jew, and his marriage seals that acceptance. Mira is so diminutive in size, so humble in demeanor, so deferential to her benefactors, that we expect her to acquiesce in everything. That is why the force of her Jewishness is all the more striking, and it expands with her growing confidence. At the point of rescue, she worries that this Prince Charming will hate her for being a Jew. Deronda declares that he is not that foolish. Yet, when he suspects that her family may be the Cones of the pawn shop, he is distressed, even offended by the possibility. In effect, he would like to be her rescuer, as he himself is of indeterminate origin, without other entanglements or competing loyalties at that point. That is not Mira. She is all about loyalties. She fled to England to escape her father, but equally to find her mother, whose lullaby she remembers as a melody without precise words, as the most ingrained feature of her being, say more than a memory, something within her. She is childlike. For one who has been exposed to so much rottenness, she seems oddly innocent, and the narrator sometimes finds it necessary to account for a naivete that some readers, I think, find hard to trust. Really? So sweet? But that may say more about us than it says about Mira. She is straightforward, plain-spoken. My mother, my own mother, used to say about such people, "Sie ist unkomplexen." She has no complexes. This is one of the highest points of praise that my mother could bestow on somebody. She has without complexes. And she doesn't have hang-ups or neuroses of this kind. Yes, she wanted to commit suicide, but it seemed that, you know, she had her reasons. If she assumes that people are going to equate Jewishness with evil, it's because of her father, who is Jewish and rotten, and because of the anti-Jewish prejudice to which she is constantly being exposed. So her fears are not terrors of the kind that overcome Gwendolyn suddenly and from some unknown source. They are rather reasonable fears of a child who was abducted by her father to be exploited for his benefit and with no regard for hers. Not for an instance, though, does her father's behavior tempt her into identifying Jewishness with evil. First, because she knows that her mother was good and her brother was good. And even as regards her father, she would not consider exchanging her identity for any other. And by identity, what does she mean? She means family, blood, kin, tribe. That's what it is for her. So Mira dominates what strikes me as one of the pivotal moments of the book. It comes in chapter 32 of 70, therefore just about the middle of the novel. During a visit of Deronda to the home of the Meyricks, the warm and welcoming British family that earned her trust and our trust, Daniel has come by to check up on his ward. She sings for him for the first time, ending with her mother's Hebrew hymn that then leads into a conversation about what is deepest in the formation of the human being. This, in turn, introduces the subject of mother love, and then of Jewish and Christian relations, with everyone striking an ecumenical tone. Mira blushes then at the reminder that Daniel is not a Jew, which tells us that she is thinking romantically, as we already know that he is too. Now, Mrs. Meyrick tries to be helpful in this. Jew, Christian, she tries to be helpful by pointing out that nations and religions can merge. My father was a Scotch Calvinist, and my mother was a French Calvinist. I am neither quite Scotch, not quite Scottish, nor quite French, nor two Calvinists rolled into one. Yet, I honor my parents' memory. Mira understands this for what it is. It's an invitation to give up her Jewishness. She insists that she could not make herself not a Jewess, even if she were to change her belief. The tribal identity would survive the loss of religious faith. The marvelous Meyrick family that has taken her in wants her to really become Christian like themselves. They don't see the problem. Why would you want to remain different? So they want to embrace her. They want her to become Jewish. And she, at that point, who has been so sweet and so thankful, really becomes quite tough. And she says to them, that is the first cruel thing you have said to me. And the tears rise in her eyes, because she feels that to ask her to abandon her Jewishness, to abandon her immediate family, even though her father has been so cruel to her, this is cruelty. And so she stands for her separateness, and she is the first one in the novel to take that position of how important separateness actually is in that sense for the Jew, for the Jewish people, as a reminder that every people needs to be able to experience itself familially, nationally, that there's nothing wrong with that, that that has very important meaning for the world at large. The Jews are just the most extreme example of a people that has had trouble holding on to its national identity, you know, in the midst of so many other peoples that have wanted to absorb it and have insisted on absorbing it. When Mrs. Meyrick cheerfully persists, she is so kind. You have to see how genuinely kind. This is part of her welcome, right? And she says that if only Jews changed their religion and stop making differences between themselves and Christians, there would come a time when there would be no Jews to be seen. And at that point, Mira begins to cry. She says, oh, please, not to say that. It is the first unkind thing you have said. I will not begin that. I will never separate myself from my mother's people. I was forced to fly from my father, but if he came back in age and weakness and want and needed me, should I say this is not my father? If he had shame, I must share it. It was he who was given to me for my father and not another, and so it is with my people. I will always be a Jewess. I will love Christians when they are good people like you, but I will always cling to my people. I will always worship with them. Now, during this speech and beyond, Mira is possessed with a sorrowful passion, says fervent, not violent, forcing the very kindly and motherly Mrs. Meyrick to realize that in her efforts to solve the problem, she has actually struck a throbbing nerve. The compassionate Christian has always felt that Judaism's embodiment in a people that stays apart is temporary and unnecessary. Having given up her parents' ethnicities and religion, Mrs. Meyrick cannot understand why Jews would not want to fold into her embrace. One could have understood that resistance when Jews could not be accepted by the rest of the world, when the rest of the world was unwilling to accept them. But now that we are willing to grant you entry and even to welcome you so warmly into our home, why would you want anything more? Why would you want to stay different? Why would you want to stay separate? A word that begins to emerge in this novel. So George Eliot was a philosopher who chose the novel as her medium because of its irreducible complexity, and that is the basis of her philosophy, that irreducible complexity. And here we see how philosophy works through the texture of an intricate dramatic sequence. The philosophic counterpart of this scene, laid out a little bit more systematically, can be found in Moses Hess's 1862 work, Rome and Jerusalem, which is written in the form of a letter to a woman in mourning and places the same emphasis on mother love as the binding source of Jewish nationhood. But it is a sustained philosophic argument for Jewish nationhood. And there too, the insistence on Jewish nationhood argues against the universalist's idea of a modern society to which all groups yield their specificity. So that same insistence on family feeling as the basis of Jewish nationhood is here personified in this little Jewess who makes the case at its most basic, uncomplicated level, because she is that person, the uncomplicated and the essential, one could say, Jew, essential Jew. Now, Deronda's reaction to this is wonderfully interesting too. To Deronda, she seemed, quote, a personification of that spirit which impelled men after a long inheritance of professed Catholicism to leave wealth and high place and risk their lives in flight, that they might join their own people and say, I am a Jew. So, having begun to know a little bit about Jewish history, he connects her with the Maranos, right, who heroically returned to their Jewish faith. That's his association, that's what he hears, this courage. Now, here's something strange about literature and how it doesn't only reflect what is and what was, but how it kind of creates an echo going further into the future. You know, I have to admit that when I read this, I shuddered at these words of Deronda in this book. Why? Because of the way he foretells the future. 6.5 decades after this book appeared, in a context not unlike that of the Maranos, the Soviet poet Itzhak Pfeffer, who had towed the Communist Party line as a member of the communist elite, risked the security of his Soviet status, this was during World War II, to write a poem which is called I Am a Jew, right? In which each stanza recalls a tragic stage of Jewish history, including that of the Spanish Inquisition, and it ends with the declaration, Ich bin a Jid, I am a Jew. And for declaring that Jewish solidarity with the Jews under Nazism, Pfeffer and all the fellow members of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee were tried as spies and executed on Stalin's orders on August the 12th, 1952. This is almost exactly 64 years ago, right? Now, would it be too dramatic to suggest that by warning against the hard and soft forms of anti-Jewish prejudice, George Eliot was trying to prevent England from going the way of inquisitorial Spain or Soviet Russia? I think she had come to realize that acceptance of the Jewish people was a necessary feature of any wholesome polity, of any wholesome civilization. So as the central figure of this scene, Mira is the first to pronounce the book's theme of national self-affirmation, and particularly of Jewish national self-affirmation. And she does so to the surprise of her English hosts, Duronda understands from this that Mira is not going to marry outside her faith. And somewhat later, he conveys this message to Hans Meyrick, who has fallen in love with her and intends to marry her. Now, Hans Meyrick is as careless about his mother about such matters. To him, it's all the same. Jew, not a Jew. Okay, if it's required, why shouldn't he become a Jew if that's what's necessary? Mrs. Meyrick and her daughters are not altogether happy with this state of affairs, but they, like Daniel, they come around to understanding that Mira is not going to repay their hospitality by blending into their family and faith. Had Mira expressed these thoughts in private, or had she just been saying this among her fellow Jews, this insistence on the tribal or the familial aspects of Judaism would have remained an internal matter. If one meets together as Jews and one affirms one's national self-identification and even makes a passionate plea for it, this is an internal matter. You see, not so in this book. Here, the question is argued in the public sphere, among others. She has to make the case before a public that does not understand it and that is not Jewish and that thinks about it in different terms. So she is raising here in the domestic sphere the questions that were being raised in the parliaments of Europe about the meaning and implications of Jewish peoplehood. National self-liberation requires getting out of the ghetto to make the case for the inclusion of Jews as a nation. So Mira's public declaration lets us see the effect of her position on others. What are the British to make of the Jews' tenacity and their intention of remaining a people apart? So these two immigrants then, Klezmer and Mira, play out two stages in the process of emancipation. The acceptance of Julian Klezmer's marriage to Catherine Arrowpoint is a welcome repudiation of the xenophobic prejudice and social bias. Greater tolerance and relaxation of snobbery and appreciation for independent standards of culture are part of England's progress toward a more liberal and more diversified citizenry. This does not happen overnight, but it is resolved in England without much Sturm und Drang, without the kind of storm and stress that characterized emancipation on the continent. And I think that many of you are familiar with Count Clermont-Tonnerre's 1789 speech to the French Assembly on the question of religious minorities, where he famously formulated the concept, "We must refuse everything to the Jews as a nation and accord everything to the Jews as individuals. They should not be allowed to form in the state either a political body or an order. They must be citizens individually. It is repugnant to have in the state an association of non-citizens and a nation within a nation." So those who sanctioned the Klezmer's marriage accept the Jews as fellow citizens, often like the Arrowpoints, with the expectation that they will eventually blend into the Christian majority. By contrast, Mira's adherence to Judaism really demands the concept of at least minority rights. The political term minority rights doesn't even do justice to the change in consciousness that was required of the country that had once expelled its Jews and had demonized them for several centuries. In its culture, Jews were not asking to be accepted simply as individuals, but as a collectivity, as a collective, a people apart. Jews themselves, you see, had no trouble with this concept. You have to understand this difference. Jews had always accepted the principle of coexistence as the natural byproduct of their exile, which they continued to mourn with the assurance that it would someday end. But in the meantime, their ability to remain a nation within a nation, it only required tenacity, the will to continue practicing their way of life. But of the British, it required something they had not practiced before, a liberality that accepted cultural difference without resentment or undue fear of competition. Could Englishmen accept the Jews in their midst as permanent residents who would not assimilate, who would marry only within their own people, even if they were no longer religiously devout? Could the English develop the same level of self-confidence that allowed the Jews to coexist with other cultures and with other peoples? So Mira, who has a supporting female role here, is in many ways better than Gwendolyn, the leading lady, not because she is determined to outshine her rival, but because of the way she is formed, because of the differences in their nature. Mira never acts against her conscience. Mira does not submit to evil when it is leveled against her, and she escapes being yoked to a husband of convenience. You see how these two things play off against one another. Despite her disrupted childhood, she has the advantage over Gwendolyn of deeply rooted family and religious affections, so that when the Meyrick girls pepper her with objections to the synagogue and Jewish ritual, could you really deal with this, sitting there apart behind that miserable, you know, thing that separates you? Is this really the kind of religious thing that you want? She simply reaffirms her attachment to feelings that she would not part with for anything in the world. And we are told Mira's religion was of one fiber with her affections and had never presented itself to her as a set of propositions. Right. So this book introduces the challenge of Jewish national autonomy through a harmless and vulnerable girl who is in need of shelter herself. The idea of nationhood could hardly have a sweeter voice, whether it is singing a mother's hymn or an Italian national aria. So in fact, as Gwendolyn becomes aware of this undeclared competition, she can hardly believe that she is expected to take it seriously, because goodness, that kind of goodness is not a category in her system of ranking. And because she has trouble considering a Jewess her equal, Mira would appear to be relatively insignificant to those who admit her into their homes and salons. And yet, although they all realize that she means them no harm, her presence disturbs their peace of mind more than anyone might have expected. And she is disruptive, you see. Her Jewishness drives an almost fatal wedge between the two former close friends, Daniel and Hans. And Gwendolyn's reaction to this Jewish exclusivity is the novel's ultimate concern. This is going to be what the novel hangs on. How is Gwendolyn going to deal with this Jewish exclusivity that excludes her, right? So despite the importance of Mira's message to the Gentiles, hers, as I say, is the supporting role, because on the whole, the main questions to be resolved concern Gwendolyn's future and Gwendolyn's character, that is to say, the future and nature of England. How Gwendolyn will react to being rejected by Deronda will tell us whether England can ever accept the distinctiveness of the Jews. The English national character is under assault, however, from other directions as well, because the evil that potentially comes from the Jews is far less threatening to England than the strain of evil that is being bred among its natives. And so what we will go on to is the question of evil in this book, as it arises from quite another source. Okay, thank you. So, looking at the way in which Klezmer and Mira are represented in this book, Klezmer, who is no longer really a Jew, the Judaism is giving way to English culture very quickly, and we see that he is being accepted by British society. So if that trend continues, the Jews would not really exist as a people very much longer. They would be entirely assimilated into English culture. That's one possibility. On the other hand, if you see Mira, who is so much in need, who is so dependent, so vulnerable, on the other hand, Can you see how the theme of nationalism, how the recovery of a Jewish polity might begin to seem much more necessary in the context of these two figures being introduced?
For additional information about the Tikva Fund, please visit tikvafund.org.